Our scripture reading this morning comes from 1 Kings chapter 17, verses 8 to 16. Then the word of the Lord came to Elijah, saying, "Go now to Zarephath, which belongs to Sidon, and live there, for I have commanded a widow there to feed you." So he set out and went to Zarephath. When he came to the gate of the town, a widow was there gathering sticks. He called to her and said, "Bring me a little water in a vessel so that I may drink." As she was going to bring it, he called to her and said, "Bring me a morsel of bread in your hand." But she said, "As the Lord your God lives, I have nothing baked, only a handful of meal in a jar and a little oil in a jug. I am now gathering a couple of sticks so that I may go home and prepare it for myself and my son, that we may eat it and then die." Elijah said to her, "Do not be afraid. Go and do as you have said, but first make me a little cake of it and bring it to me, and afterwards make something for yourself and your son. For thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, the jar of meal will not be emptied, and the jug of oil will not fail until the day that the Lord sends rain on the earth." She went and did as Elijah said, so that she, as well as he and her household, ate for many days. The jar of meal was not emptied, neither did the jug of oil fail, according to the word of the Lord that he spoke by Elijah. This is the word of the Lord. On Saturday nights, I am usually hanging out with some friends. Two couples who between them have three girls ages 1.5, almost 3, and 3.5. After dinner, the adults bring out the board games, which means that the girls get to watch a movie, which means that more Saturday nights than not, I am playing board games with Frozen playing in the background. And I'm not mad about that. I love Frozen. Most of the time, the girls get bored and they wander off to go play, and then it's just the adults left singing along to the soundtrack as the movie plays in the background. I also just think it's a great movie with a great story. It's a story that has some surprises. If it's like every other Disney princess movie before it, the storyline would go something like this. The girl falls in love with a handsome man, undergoes some ordeal, the prince comes and saves her, and everyone lives happily ever after. Not so with Frozen. While Anna, the one sister, does fall in love by the end of the movie, it is not with the dashing and handsome Prince Hans who initially sweeps her off her feet. He turns out to be the worst. Instead, the screenwriters flip the script of the usual narrative, and Anna falls in love with the rough and tumble, kind of crude and yet funny and lovable Kristoff, who is just a lowly ice deliverer. And we think we know how the ordeal, the crisis of the movie, is going to be resolved. Elsa, the other sister, has a magic power she can't control. She turns things into ice when her emotions flare. And in a fit of emotion, she hits Anna with a blast of ice, and Anna's heart begins to freeze. And the wise trolls that they go visit say that only an act of true love will unfreeze her heart, which Olaf the snowman takes to mean a kiss from Prince Hans, because that's how the story goes. But the person who saves Anna in the end is not Hans, because he's the worst, remember? It's Elsa, her sister, who returns to her sister and grabs hold of her frozen form, weeping with love. And slowly, Anna begins to thaw and return to normal. They flipped the script, took a narrative that we were used to, a storyline we expected, and then threw in a surprise, caught us off guard to make us think about all the different kinds of true love that exist in the world. And that's what any good script flip does. It catches us off guard. It challenges the assumptions we make and makes us think about what's happening in the story in these moments when something different happens. The story of Elijah and the widow is very much a flipped script story. It is chock full of surprise, of moments that make us say, wait, what? We're in the middle in this story. We're in the middle of the reign of King Ahab. And if Prince Hans is bad, King Ahab is the worst of the worst. Chapter 16 tells us that Ahab did evil in the sight of the Lord more than all who were before him. And as if it had been a light thing for him to walk in the sins of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, he took as his wife Jezebel, daughter of King Ethbaal of the Sidonians, and went and served Baal and worshipped him. Ahab angers God, serves foreign gods, marries a foreign woman who is just as prone to evil as he is. He takes advantage of the poor and kills all those who would stand in his way. And so God sends a messenger to Ahab, Elijah the Tishbite from Gilead. Through Elijah, God tells Ahab that he is going to send a drought. No rain, no dew for 3 years, which is a very direct in-your-face to Baal. Because Baal is the god of fertility, the god who rides the clouds, the god who sends rain on the earth. For God to say, there will be no rain except by my hand, is another way of saying to the people, oh, you believe in this Baal? Let's see if he's as powerful as you think. Unsurprisingly, this news angers King Ahab, and so Elijah goes into hiding. God directs him to the river Kerith, from which he drinks, and he gets his food delivered to him by ravens. Until finally, the river dries up too as a result of the drought. So God sends him to a new place, bringing us to surprise number one. God tells Elijah to go to Zarephath in Sidon. And Zarephath just happens to be the hometown of dear Queen Jezebel. This is the very heart of Baal country. Instead of sending Elijah further from danger, God sends him straight into enemy territory. If God is going to make a point, he's going to do it where that point will be felt most profoundly. Surprise number two. God tells Elijah to ask for food from a widow. And we know, we've seen in other stories like that of Ruth, that widows are almost always the people in a society that have the least. They have no way of providing for themselves. And so in Israelite society, at least, the people are commanded by God to leave some grain along the edges of the fields that the widows can come and glean and provide for themselves. Well, in Sidonian society, who knows if there's any similar kind of safety net? We can assume that there is not, for this widow speaks to Elijah of scarcity. She's out collecting a couple of sticks so she can cook up her handful of meal and little oil. It will be her last meal, and then she and her son will just wait to die. It is ludicrous. It's shameful, even, for Elijah to ask this widow, then, to feed him first. But this is what God tells him to do. Surprise number three. Elijah, the prophet of doom and gloom, who's usually telling folks in power, be afraid, be very afraid, speaks with gentleness and confidence to this woman who has run out of luck. Don't be afraid. God, my God, will ensure that you have enough. Elijah, a man of God, a man of power, is vulnerable enough in this moment to ask for help, to say that he stands in need, and to ask for help from the least likely of people to give him help. Because he trusts God, he knows that God will provide. And so we have surprise number four, maybe the biggest surprise of the whole story. The woman trusts too. This woman who knows of Elijah's God, but does not know this God, yet trusts the promise that Yahweh makes. She gives Elijah the last of what she has. And God, note that God does not fill her jar first. Doesn't give a visible sign of his provision first. She takes what she has and makes food for Elijah before even feeding herself and her son. She trusts, and God provides. In the middle of Baal territory, in the midst of a people who trust Baal to provide, God says, "It is I who provide. I am the giver of all good things." And to really prove his point, to prove his power, he shows his provision in the direst of circumstances, in the unlikeliest of ways, through this interaction of the unlikeliest of people in a story full of surprise. God flips the script. If we were writing this narrative, we would have expected Elijah to flee as far from Sidon as possible. We would have sent him off to a foreign land not affected by drought. We would have been waiting for the widow to die a tragic death, or at least expected Elijah to come alongside her and give her one last meal. Because this is what we are used to. These are our assumptions of how the world works. Those in danger seek protection. Those who are on the bottom of the pecking order don't have feature roles in the story. They don't have a lot of agency. But God does not operate based on our assumptions. He doesn't stick to the narratives that we think make sense. Yahweh is a God of surprise, and so he sends Elijah into danger, gives the widow this agency in the story, makes his messenger of his power the vulnerable one, and provides food where there should be no hope of sustenance. God flips the script. I wonder what scripts need to be flipped in our own lives. What assumptions are we living out of? What narratives are we writing for others and for ourselves? Where do we need to create room in our lives for God to surprise us? And specifically, since we're reading this story of Elijah and widow, what narratives of provision, of scarcity and abundance are shaping our expectations, our motivations, our decisions? In our script, is there enough to go around? Are we the people who proclaim, "Do not be afraid," or are we the people who live in fear of scarcity? In our conversations about immigration and welfare and community resources, we need wisdom, to be sure. But are those conversations governed, perhaps limited, by our already established narratives and expectations? Because too often I think our script, our narrative, tells us that there is not enough, that we need to protect what's ours, that too much generosity might just lead to chaos. But God flips that script, tells his people to look out for the least among us, the widow, the orphan, the stranger. Reminds us that everything we own is a gift. and could be taken from our hands just as easily as it was given. So to hold on to things loosely calls us to live generously and openly because he is the source of all good things, and he brings food via ravens and fills jars of meal that are almost empty. He flips the script and calls us to trust him, not our stockpile of goods. So how does that script, that story, change how we think about wealth, about country, about community, about resources? In our script, are there people who are worth helping and people who are not? It's so easy for us to ascribe narratives to people based on what they look like or how they smell, how they speak or behave, and to base our responses to those people based on those prescribed narratives. We don't want to waste our good deeds on someone who's just going to squander our generosity. So we size people up by their cardboard signs or their appearance or their language, and we try to figure out if this is a good person to be nice to, if this person will be worth our trouble, if in this case our grace won't be wasted. But God flips that script too. Jesus ate with tax collectors, with sinners, with lepers, those who were on the fringes of society because of their lifestyle choices, or their jobs, or their past mistakes, or their mental or physical health. So how does that God flip the script on our narratives of worth? And in our script, are we always the providers? The ones with power, the ones with resources, the ones who are in a position to give? And is this the only way to live out our calling? Because I think that's what we all long to do. We want to be generous. We want to follow God. We want to give. We want to use the power and privilege we have well. But what if God has flipped the script on what power looks like? What if using our power well does not mean we operate from a place of might, but from a place of vulnerability? After all, Elijah only empowers and emboldens this woman to trust God by he himself saying, "I too am hungry," by expressing his own need, by being vulnerable. And after all, the Son of God did not come into the world fitting the narratives and expectations of the Jewish people. He was not a mighty king or a warrior. He didn't lord about his power and authority. He walked around in worn-out sandals, depended on the generosity of others for his meals, didn't have a roof over his head, hung out with the least of these. Jesus flipped the script on what it means to be powerful. He flipped the script on a lot of things because he also didn't run from danger, didn't go in the opposite direction of the death he knew was waiting for him. He didn't try to protect himself. He didn't look at the people he had come to save, the people who needed his help, and see how they were squandering, how we squander his love and goodness and mercy and say, "Forget it. They aren't worth saving." He did not put a limit on his love. He flipped the script. This is how Dane Ortlund puts it. "God didn't meet us halfway. He refused to hold back, cautious, assessing our worth. That is not his heart. He and his Son took the initiative on terms of grace and grace alone. in defiance of what we deserved. When we, despite our smiles and civility, were running from God as fast as we could, building our own kingdoms and loving our own glory, lapping up the fraudulent pleasures of the world, repulsed by the beauty of God and shutting up our ears at his calls to come home. It was then, in the hollowed out horror of that revolting existence, that the Prince of Heaven bade his adoring angels farewell. It was then that he put himself into the murderous hands of these very rebels, in a divine strategy planned from eternity past to rinse muddy sinners clean and hug them into his own heart, despite their squirmy attempt to get free and scrub themselves clean on their own. There are no limits on a love like that. God's mercy does not run out. And so will we be still from our striving, from our clutches at power and autonomy, and reach instead for that mercy? Will we say, I too am hungry, and so come to this table where there is more than enough, where there is always more than enough? Will we give of ourselves, our time, our money, our energy, our whole lives, because it is all a gift from the one who gave his own life? Will we trust that there is enough? Will we pause the narratives that we have written and see how God is flipping the script? Would you pray with me?